on today's Run to the Top podcast.
If you're doing too much training, where you are constantly on the verge of non-functional overreaching, maybe even overtraining syndrome, there is no fancy drink. There's no amount of sleep. There is nothing you can eat to make that go away. The only answer is to do less. You have to bring your training volume down.
Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast from Runners Connect, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. Together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now here's your host, Stephanie K. Atwood.
Welcome. This is Stephanie K. Atwood, Boston Marathon qualifier, coach, and host for the Run to the Top podcast. How is everybody today? I don't know. For some reason, I'm feeling very energetic. I don't know if it's because daylight savings time has changed or whatever. But anyway, getting on with today's program, an annual comprehensive training plan that includes cross-training, recovery time, nutrition, and of course, running with a few big race goals is all part of the term periodization. Today, Dr. James Hoffman will break down some of the details of an integrated annual training plan that can help you peak when you want to by coordinating those three big parts: body, mind, and spirit in that unique individual that comprises you. We'll discuss the science and the art of training and coaching, fatigue, adaptation, recovery, tapering, peaking, and more. I'll tell you a bit more about today's guest, and then we'll let him fill in the details. So Dr. James Hoffman holds a PhD in sport physiology and is a consultant for Renaissance Periodization. He's a former program director of the Exercise and Sport Science Program and the women's rugby team coach at Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He has taught courses in strength and conditioning theory, strength and conditioning practice, exercise physiology, and biochemistry. He's recently published his newest collaborative book called, this is a long title, my gosh, I'm not going to remember it if I didn't have it written down, Integrated Periodization in Sports Training and Athletic Development, Combining Training Methodology, Sports Psychology, and Nutrition to Optimize Performance. That's the whole title. And he has some great suggestions for runners and coaches who want to understand better how to create phases of training for planned results through periodization. Periodization allows for creating calculated major goals and measured improvement in short-term, mid-term, and long-range objectives. And we've got the right guy here to talk to us about it. Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast, Dr. Hoffman.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm sorry for such lengthy book titles and the like. I know it's a pain. And the company I work for also has a really long name. And it's always hard to get people to join on because I'm like, oh, it's this big, goofy thing. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, once they get some of the key words, then maybe they can just search for it by, you know, keywords and not have to try and remember the whole title.
But I know. And even if they remember the title, even spelling it's hard enough.
I agree with you. Now, I introduced you as Dr. Hoffman, but may I call you James?
Absolutely. Please.
Okay. Thank you. So let's, before we get into the details of periodization and integrated periodization, let's talk about the four general questions that we always ask at the beginning of the podcast. Are you a runner? And if so, how long have you been running? Where were you born? Where are you living now? And what is your favorite current training workout or racing distance?
I feel like I might be chastised by your listeners, but I am not a runner in the truest sense. I've always ran as part of my sport training. I've always been involved in things like football, rugby, and there's plenty of running in those sports. And so running has always been part of my training regimen, but I'm not someone who would compete in endurance sport. If I tried, it would be so pitiful. Like the cleanup crew, the pace person would be sweeping me up. It would be awful. But I've always been involved in running as more of a necessity rather than a passion. So that's where I'm at with that, unfortunately. I wish it was more. But I do run regularly. I do some trail running. I do a lot of rucking and hiking and things like that.
Yeah, it makes sense. You and I talked about this a little bit before we started the interview. And most people, and you as a coach as well as an active person, most of us use running, even if it's not the major focus of what we're doing.
Yeah, exactly. It checks a lot of boxes for us in a lot of other sports. Like you just coincidentally have to run around. So it makes a lot of sense for a lot of different people.
Right.
So I was in Chicago, Illinois, which is a great place to run. It's flat as a pancake. Currently, I'm living in Southern California in Orange County, which is the complete opposite. It's very, very rugged, rocky, hilly, mountainy, which is really great because I love hiking and I love getting on the trail and doing a lot of that kind of stuff.
Nice.
And I've been getting more and more into like periodizing my own run training. So I just came off of a very long stretch of doing some high intensity intermittent runs pretty regularly for several months. And now I'm actually sort of transitioning my training towards rucking again, because in Southern California, the winter and the springtime is actually a really nice time to go hiking because the temperature's cooler and the visibility is a little bit better. So, because sometimes in the summer it gets a little smoggy. So I'm transitioning my cardio training now a little bit more towards rucking. So I'm toning down the running, toning up the rucking a little bit.
All right. So let's start by defining integrated periodization, and how does it apply to runners?
Yeah. So the integrated periodization concept has two major bullets, right? The first one is that traditionally people have looked at periodization as kind of just their X's and O's of training, right? So I'm doing this run, I'm doing my long, slow distance here, I'm doing my tempo here, I'm doing my hit here, I'm doing my peaking and tapering stuff here. And that's what people thought periodization was and is. What myself and the main writer of the book, Tudor Bompa, he's been saying this for decades. And he's kind of, if you guys aren't familiar with exercise and sports science, he's kind of like the Elvis Presley of our field. He's the man, right? He's
understood.
Like the person people think of when they think of periodization. And he said, yeah, you know, there's a lot of that training stuff. That's great. But we also have to think about nutrition. We also have to think about psychological preparation and recovery strategies. And unfortunately, what we tend to do is think of those as separate entities and then try to piecemeal them together when we should be thinking of them as part of the whole picture. And that's kind of what integrated periodization seeks to do, where we say, let's not treat nutrition as its own thing. Let's include all of these things so they kind of converge into the same goal, same timeline, and the like.
You can see why that would be so complicated, because you're taking science and you're taking what some other sort of intangible and trying to combine them into a person for the highest potential that that person has.
Yeah. So we kind of try to seek combining the available science with the individual, right? With the experience and the anecdote that individual has. They know how they respond to certain things. They have a history to back that up. And so we put the two things together the best we can. And then kind of the other big bullet point, I think, for integrated periodization is kind of answering the question of what should I be doing and when, right? So we have all these different potential things that you could be doing. Should I be working, like if you're a triathlon runner, should I be working on my swim to cycle transitions or my cycle to running transitions? If you are, doing running as a means to another sport, should I be working on integrating some different techniques? Should I be working on my intra-race nutrition? Should I try this goo or this gel or food? When are the most times to do that? And integrated periodization says, okay, well, we have all these things, and we can converge them down and say, when you are preparing for certain things at certain times, we can also say, this is what you should be doing on the training, nutrition, and psychology side of things. So a really common example is when people are prepping for a race, you know, should I be doing strength training? When should I be including my strength training portion of my run training? When's the best time to do that, right? Integrated periodization helps us kind of narrow those timelines down.
Now, clarify for us, we're kind of talking about an annual type of plan, and then we're breaking that down into smaller phases. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's kind of the traditional sports scientist view. Now, most laypersons might not do that. They might just look at it a couple months at a time, and that's perfectly fine. As a sports scientist, what we typically would do is we would look at the whole year, and we would kind of outline all of the major competitions or big important events that are important to the individual, to the runner, even if it's not a Boston Marathon. Even wire kind of thing. This is important to me. And so we're going to map all those things out. And once we know when those competitions and events are, then we can actually start breaking our training down into smaller phases, which are building up and managing our fatigue into those competitions. So that's the idea. So for somebody like me, I would do it on like a yearly scale. But for many of your listeners, it might just be like, okay, I got 3 months until this run that I'm going to compete in. How do I kind of build myself up to that 3 month period? And that's perfectly fine too.
But part of this annual idea is that if you're going to peak at a certain time and there's something that's really important to you, let's say it's the Boston Marathon, for example, then part of this whole annual idea is that you don't want to have so many other peaking events that you're not able to, high peak, super peak at the Boston.
Oh my God, I'm so glad you brought that up. That's a great point. That's that in a lot of other sports, and I don't want to deviate from running, but there's a couple sports that are really guilty of that, CrossFit in particular. But yes, one of the problems that we have is when you do a proper peaking protocol, it takes a little bit of time, mm-hmm. right? It takes time to bring down that fatigue and that preparedness up, which is great for performance. But what's the downside? Well, the downside is you're actually just taking away time that you could potentially be training. So to your point, what we usually recommend is for people to only do a true full like taper peaking protocol for maybe 1 to 2 competitions throughout the year, just because it's so much time spent doing this other stuff that's not making you better, long-term better. Mm-hmm. And so for other competitions, like if you're doing things for fun or if you're doing like a charity run or, you know, a 5K in your neighborhood or something like that, you don't have to do a full peaking tapering program for that. You can just take a couple light days throughout the week and you're probably fine. And then it's back to the grind. You know what I mean? Yeah. A lot of people think like, oh, I got this 5K coming up. I'm going to taper for 2 weeks. It's like, why? It's a 5K. You'll be fine. You could just take a light couple days leading into the event and you'll be.
And one of the things, I mean, I'm a coach. And so, you know, I'm really interested in this stuff in coaching ways, because it seems to me that you need to look at the individual as a whole, and as an individual, as a unique individual, but also their whole lifestyle. I know you've got more information on that, but in terms of this annual plan, it's like, it's not that you can't do other races during this year, but maybe look at those as putting in, this is one of the things I was taught, 100% into that, but having these true peaking events that are maybe 2 in a year at 105% or 102%, you know, it's everything goes into those.
Yeah. And that's a great way of looking at it. For me, it's an idea of kind of like a triage system or a priority mm-hmm. system where mm-hmm. you say like, these are two that are just so important to me. I will be devastated if this does not work the way that I want it to go. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then after that, it's just a matter of like, well, I have other ones that are going to maybe make me happy, or I'm going to have a good time, or it's for a good cause, or all these other reasons why you might do a race.
Right.
But I don't want to take too much time out of peaking for the ones that are important to me. So at that point, it's just a matter of trade-offs. And that's when having a good coach, like somebody like yourself, can help people get guided in the right direction, where you say like, yeah, you know, you got this, you know, 10K coming up. It's cool, but you really are trying to qualify for Boston next year. Why don't we save up some of this effort and energy and fuss for more important things later on?
Yeah. Or even use the 10K or the 5K as a training type of run so that you've got a calculated plan for it. But it's more of looking at it as part of the bigger picture of qualifying for Boston.
Absolutely agree.
Okay. And I also read this or heard you say this. I thought it was so great. There is a science to training and an art to coaching. I love that, because part of that is actually the relationship that you have with your coach if you're working with a coach. But talk about that, the science to training, because I love science, and an art to coaching. That is such an integral part as well.
Oh man, I stand by that. I've been saying that for years. It's one of these things, like I think, especially in the, I'm really thrilled that the evidence-based community has been growing and growing and growing the last mm-hmm. several years. So mm-hmm. most people are at least flirting with the idea of evidence-based, if not fully embracing it. But then we also get into this problem where we tend to sit on like this, like a high horse or kind of the ivory tower in science, where it's easy to find a paper or something that says like this one particular thing maybe doesn't work the way you think it does. And then what that causes is people to kind of foo-foo or poo-poo on ideas, right? Where people say like, oh, I'm doing this part of my training. And people say, that's dumb. Why are you doing that, right? And although you might be righteous in what the science says, you're certainly not building any rapport or a good relationship with that athlete or with that individual by just poo-pooing on them all the time, right? And unfortunately, I've had some mentors over the years who have gone around the world and unfortunately, they're not very well received, even though they have great, insightful things to say. So part of being a good coach is not only being able to disseminate that good scientific information to your athlete, but also getting them to do what you want them to do by building a really good rapport. And sometimes that might mean asking them to do something that is maybe not the most valid or most scientifically backed thing to do, but it gets the end result that you want. And one of the mm-hmm. funny ones that we use in at my other job at RP is this idea of massage. And massage has been something that people have explored as a recovery modality for a long time. But when you actually research it, it doesn't seem to do a lot of physical effects, believe it or not.
Interesting.
But what's the, so where's the science and where's the art of coaching, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the science says there's not a lot of physical recovery going on with massage. But what's also happening, you're getting that person to relax, put their cell phone down, just lay down for a little bit, right? And we know that relaxation has a huge, massive benefit. So what is the outcome that I want? Well, I want my athlete to relax and I can't get while, what can I do? Well, the art of coaching would say, get something that gets that same effect, right? Like say, go get a massage. All that is doing is getting them the outcome measurement that you want, which is relaxation, right? Is the massage doing something in particular? Maybe, maybe not, but it's getting the outcome. And that's where like having a good rapport, having a good relationship with your athlete is really important. Because I'm sure you get stuff like this all the time where come to you and say like, what do you think about keto for running? And you might, you know, you might it'd be easy to say like, that's dumb, right? But then this person might have been doing keto for the last 5 years. So what have you essentially done to them? You just crushed all of their hopes and dreams and aspirations because this is what they had been doing and they thought it was the right path and you just pooped on them, right? And so now that person is going to double down, not be interested in what you have to say and mostly just be defensive, right? It's a terrible way of going about it.
Right. So,
We have to strike the right balance, right? Where we have science and science helps guides us, but we also have individuals and relationships that we have to manage. And that's where the art of coaching comes in.
And science changes. That's what research is about. What we knew 100 years ago is not, you know, is not necessarily the same as what we know now and what we're doing now.
I totally agree. And that's one thing we try to, as scientists, we try not to speak in absolutes where we say like, this is true or this is false or this is good or this is bad.
Yeah.
We tend to speak in probabilities and that's, some people think that wishy-washy way of going about it, but it's for that exact reason. It's because these things change. 10 years from now, I might have to go back and look at something that I said and go, yeah, I was totally wrong. We just didn't know that much at the time. This is the best guess that we made. It happens.
It reminds me of, you know, Dr. Tim Noakes and— And he, of course, has worked with Tudor Bompa. And he, as you know, I mean, he completely reversed the whole way of eating for endurance athletes. And we do have a podcast about him. But this is the kind of thing where, based on the research that he saw, he literally turned it upside down with his version of it. Now, believe me, I understand not everyone agrees with that, but he's got a very convincing argument. And so that's one of those things where dramatic change within a relatively short period of time for endurance runners.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think Tim in particular is guilty of being a bit of a provocateur. I think sometimes he says things to be just inflammatory for their own sake.
I like that.
Yeah, which is fine. I think, and he gets plenty of attention. The thing with being a provocateur, which I think is bad, is that the things that he says, like when he kind of is introducing the central governor model of fatigue, or when he's talking about, you know, becoming fat adapted, all these things, there is definitely truth within there. Mm-hmm. But when you present it in a way that's so different from the consensus on the scientific community, where you say, like you said, flip-flopped 180. That's when you get so much pushback from people. They say, no, this is like so well established. How could this be so different? They're maybe not willing to see that bit of truth that's actually in there, where it's like, no, there's actually something fruitful and worth discussing here. But because it was presented maybe in a provocative way, people double down and push back. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, I totally know what you're saying. And I love actually bringing up controversial subjects on this podcast, because for me, it's fun, because I love research. I think science is so important. And yet it is changing all of the time. And that's the nature of science. We want to be looking at it and keep continuing to change the way that we, you know, test things.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of it's just trial and error too. Like
exactly.
Some people have great ideas and sometimes there's no science to back it up. So you just got to go for it and try it, see what happens.
Now, fatigue and recovery is a huge part of what we as runners use to adapt and become better runners. And so can you talk about the whole fatigue recovery cycle and how that fits into periodization? Include words like relaxation, which you've already alluded to, touch, active recovery. Tell us more about this area of periodization.
Oof, man. Yeah. So this is a huge doozy. And actually we did a whole book on recovery stuff in the other company that I work for, RP. So I'll try and give it like a quick summary, right?
Okay.
So the idea with fatigue, right, is we have a concept we call the fitness fatigue paradigm, which basically says this: in order to get more fit, you have to go and do training, right? Duh, no brainer there, right? But concurrently, that training that you're doing is also generating fatigue.
Right.
Unfortunately for us, the new fitness adaptations that we want to express over time are generally masked by the fatigue that we carry around. And most of our new fitness adaptations generally will not even manifest until fatigue has been alleviated. So we have this conundrum of, I need to train to get more fit, but the more I train, the more fatigue I generate, which brings up this idea of fatigue management. And so there's a lot of different ways that we have like an entire book on it But here's kind of the quick and dirty of what are some of the best ways of managing fatigue and some good recovery strategies. The first one that we determined to be the most important thing, the biggest choke point, hands down, was managing what we call your volume landmarks, which basically is a really fancy way of saying, are you doing enough training to be stimulative? But are you doing too much so much that you cannot recover, right? And what we found is that if you are chronically under training, right, recoverability is just not a limiting factor. Really, the limiting factor, you getting better, is just train more, right?
Yeah.
But if you're doing too much training, where you are constantly on the verge of non-functional overreaching, maybe even overtraining syndrome, there is no fancy drink. There's no amount of sleep. There is nothing you can eat to make that go away. The only answer is to do less. You have to bring your training volume down. So that's the biggest one. So we say training within what we call your volume landmarks, which is like the dose response of training. After that, we get into some of the more obvious ones. Sleep is the second choke point that we have determined. If you are or heroin or whatever you want to say, like Gatorade, you can't get around this idea of sleep. You have to get enough sleep. How much sleep is going to be a little bit variable depending on the person, right?
Right.
And there's a really great book for your listeners if you're not already familiar with Matthew Walker's Why We Sleep. It's available as a PDF and an audiobook. Excellent book on sleep stuff if you're interested.
Why We Sleep. I like that.
Yeah, I don't want to get his title wrong. He's a doctor. I believe he's a neuroscientist. I don't want to get it wrong, but it's a really great book and gives really, really good recommendations and insight on sleep.
Nice.
And after that, we kind of move into some other ones where we're looking at things like relaxation, stress management. We kind of move up the tier. We start looking at nutritional things like, are you getting enough calories? Are you getting enough carbohydrates? Is your timing of meals appropriate? We get into active recovery stuff, like are you taking deloads? Are you doing active recovery stuff? Are you taking light sessions? Are you tapering for your competitions? And then kind of we move our way up the people are most interested in, which is like your massage, your ice bath, and your compression garments and stuff like that, which are all valid, but it turns out that they just have a very small effect size and are probably not a huge bang for your buck. Whereas like training, nutrition, and lifestyle tend to be the hugest bang for your buck, hands down.
Training, nutrition, and lifestyle. Yeah, that's pretty much that's the whole person, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's one of those things, like I'm sure your high school coach told you in so many words the same thing growing up when you were either in PE class or doing sports. They would tell you, like, just train hard, just eat well, and, you know, make sure you're not, like, getting in fights and out doing drugs and stuff all the time. Like, then you'll be good, right? Well, it turns out that's probably the best advice you ever got in terms of your sport career. You know what I mean? It ends up being true. So in exercise science, we say that we do simple things for complicated reasons. And so this is one of those instances where what are the most important things? Well, like managing how much you're training is probably, it's a simple idea. It's justified. Same thing with nutrition and other things.
Now, can you talk more about active recovery? Because I think that's a tough one. You know, can we keep training while we're recovering so that we actually are not so fatigued that we can improve? How does that all balance?
Yeah. So active recovery is probably the most fun one for me to talk about because my background is primarily in sport physiology and training stuff. So this is more my bread and butter than anything else. Mm-hmm. So what we have found is that volume tends to be which is another way of saying how much training you're doing.
Yeah.
Tends to be a key modulator in fatigue. So it's kind of like a dial on a soundboard. If you push the dial up, more training, more fatigue. And if you bring it down, less fatigue. So one of the things that we have found is that actually doing what we would call a light training session, which is where you would do maybe like 50% to maybe even just like a third of what a normal training session would be, in many cases, actually improve recovery outcomes more than doing nothing at all. And it turns out just doing that training alone stimulates muscle contraction, which can stimulate things like insulin sensitivity and glucose transport across the cell, just enough to get the mechanisms of those cellular mechanisms kind of moving, just enough to promote that same recovery adaptive response without concurrently generating a ton of training fatigue from like normal overload training. So what we have found is that things like light sessions and deloads are really, really good bangs for your buck if you are finding yourself in an inappropriate fatigue state. So what that means is you have maybe your training plan planned out. You know that in the beginning, you're probably going to feel okay because you're relatively not fatigued. And as the training goes on, you're like, okay, I know I'm supposed to be getting more and more fatigued at some point. So you might find yourself like midway through your training program, your measure cycle, and you're like, I am way, way more fatigued. I'm like dying over here. What is happening?
Mm-hmm.
One of the easiest ways to fix that is just by taking only cutting it down by like a half to maybe even like a third of what you would normally do for a couple days and see if you bounce back. And more often than not, That's one of the easiest ways to fix somebody who is in a bad fatigue state. Now, that being said, sometimes they're in a really bad fatigue state, and this could be a combination of training and lifestyle factors. Like if you're, you know, you're somebody, a loved one has passed away, or you're having a lot of hard time with your job, or you're having relationship trouble, something like that.
Yeah.
That also will add fatigue, right? And so that can, you can find your runner in a really bad state just because they have bad lifestyle stuff going on. And in that case, something more powerful, like a deload, which would be like a taking light sessions for upwards of like a week, maybe even more, might be more appropriate, and it's more powerful. So it turns out, though, it works really well. And one of the best ways to actually bring down fatigue and conserve your adaptations is to do light exercise. The alternative of doing no exercise also brings down fatigue, but it doesn't conserve your fitness adaptations. So that's kind of the downside of doing it that way.
Okay, question for you here on volume. If you're decreasing the intensity by half, are you actually talking about a slower pace, or are you talking about a slower or less distance, or are you talking about some of both? How does that actually translate for a runner?
For a runner, the volume would be either the duration or distance that you covered, mm-hmm. and then the intensity would be the pace at which you cover it. Mm-hmm. So you could either look at like your miles per minute, or you could also look at like your heart rate or kind of perceived exertion. So
would you do both, or would you just do one or the other? Like, would you still run for, you know, 15 miles, but you'd slow down for that training run? Or would you run 5 miles or 10 miles instead of 15 at a slower pace?
Great question. So there's one of them you need to do, and the other one is optional. So the one that you need to do is bring down the distance and or duration. So that one is non-negotiable. So mm-hmm. if you want to use things like deloads and light sessions, you have to bring down the total workload, right? Now, within mm-hmm. that, you can make it easier, and so you actually not push as hard of a pace. Or very often what we do is have people maintain the same pace that they normally would, just mm-hmm. bring the volume down. So both are good. And endurance sports, usually the volume is going to be more of a key modulator, whereas in something like weightlifting or powerlifting, the intensity, so like how much weight is on the bar in that case, would be mm-hmm. more important potentially. So for runners, it's going to be how many miles are you putting in per week? You got to put in an easier week.
So you could do instead of doing a 10 mile, let's say for the week, 30 miles for the week, you'd do 15 miles for the week at maybe the same pace as you had been doing 30 miles before, but you give yourself a couple days or maybe up to a week, depending on what's going on for this active recovery. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And there's more advanced ways to do it too. So mm-hmm. like another option you could do is like the first, you know, maybe two or three runs that you did that week were at the target pace, just mm-hmm. less distance. Mm-hmm. And then the last ones that you did, you actually do a volume and intensity decrease where you run less and at a very casual, not difficult pace. And that would be like for people who are in a really, really bad fatigue state, you would want to do both. And that would really help bounce back. And one of the things that you'll notice if you do that, and you know that you've done a good job, is when people are kind of reluctant to do it, where they're like, this is dumb. I don't want to do this. This is so easy. When can I train hard again?
Yeah.
That's the exact response you want. That means you did a good job with that fatigue management. They are ready to go.
Nice. That's really useful. Now, how does that fit into the whole annual plan? There've got to be times when you're going to be going really intensely, and then other times when you pull back your whole training. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So usually the competition periods are where we're going to start any discussion about what our training should be at any given time. So we look mm-hmm. at the competition periods and we work our way backwards. That those competitions are probably, except for the tapering period, but before that is going to be probably the most hard training that you're going to be doing for that time. And then knowing the individual, knowing how they respond, you can kind of plan your general preparatory and specific preparatory periods accordingly. And what's really neat is once you kind of mapped a couple months out for both of those things, you might still have like a good 5 months throughout the year to kind of do whatever it is that you want.
Yeah.
And I'm sure many of your listeners don't just run. I'm sure they also maybe do weight training, or maybe they're trying to lose weight, or maybe they mm-hmm. want to do other sports and activities. And then you mm-hmm. could say like, okay, well, I have basically my running season, for lack of a better term, and I've mapped out my training for that. But then I have this huge chunk of time throughout the year where I can kind of do whatever. And then you might say, okay, at those times, I might actually bring my running training down to maintenance volume mm-hmm. and then ramp up something else like my strength training so I can be maybe more muscular and look better for Instagram or whatever it is that you want to do. I don't care, right? But it's actually, if you guys want a really good thing like that, There's a gentleman named Alex Viata, and his programming is called the Hybrid Athlete. And he does powerlifting and running, and he talks about how to manage those two sports within the same kind of annual structure.
Oh, I love that. And I love this because strength training, I wanted to talk to you about that. It's something that I think a lot of us do find it's hard to fit it into a training program, but you've just allowed that opportunity. And talk about strength training and how it benefits optimum performance for runners.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's kind of two areas that we would tackle in terms of strength training. The first one is body composition, right? So One of the problems that you would run into with a runner is if you're way too muscled, ironically. So you could have somebody who's like really, really buff, maybe like 220 pounds at like 10% body fat. That's awesome. I'm sure you look great for Instagram, but you're going to have a really hard time trying to do something like a Badwater or any type of really tough endurance event. Why? Carrying so much mass, it's just a very inefficient way of running. So one of the first things we would look at is, can I optimize my body composition for the sports and things that I'm interested in? Now, for a pure runner, we typically see a very lean, not super heavily muscled person. But if you're not just a pure competitor, you might want a balance of muscularity and running capacity, right? And that would be a very negotiable thing that you could work out with your coach. Mm-hmm. So that one's a little bit up in the air, depending on the individual and what they want. Mm-hmm. But after that, we move into strength. And what we know is that strength is definitely something that is useful for running, right? Yes. Especially when you are doing, when you have terrain that you're navigating. When it's flat, like strength training is still beneficial, but maybe not the most beneficial thing. When you're managing terrain, strength training can be very useful for maintaining a good high power output while you're running and preventing injuries or just getting destroyed from doing a lot of downhill stuff, right? So strength training is something that should be incorporated. Typically, what we would see is when you are way, way away from competition, you might see a slightly more strength training portion of your program, or maybe you're doing it 3 or 4 days a week, which for a runner is a lot. And then as you start moving towards your competitive periods, when you have your general preparatory phases and your specific preparatory phases, we would still keep some strength training in there, but it would probably be going down to like 2 to 3 times per week. And as we get closer and closer and closer to the actual competitions, we would basically take our strength training volume and put it down at maintenance volumes, which is basically just enough to not lose muscle mass and strength, but not enough to actually stimulate strength gains any further.
So and create more fatigue, right? I mean, you're trying to really focus on exactly what you're going to be competing in.
Yeah. So what you wouldn't want to do is say like, okay, well, I got this run coming up. I need to put as much running in as I can. So I'm going to throw strength training out the window. It's a good idea, but then what happens? Well, then you just decondition your muscle mass and your strength for that whole period of time. So what we would say is, well, what we wanted, and that's part of the volume landmarks thing that we were talking about earlier. What we would say is we move things from volumes to maintenance volumes to accommodate whatever thing that is the bigger priority at the time. So as you get closer to your running competitions, the dial on the strength training volume comes down, the dial on the running volume goes up, you know, and vice versa.
Very interesting. And your book has a lot of charts and it's, I would have to say that book is like, it's like a coach's guide or something. I mean, it's like a lot of white papers or something. It's very, you know, there's a lot of information in there. And I think if an average runner wanted to look at it, that either they might want to consider looking at it with a coach or at least be aware that there is so much information and take it, you know, a little bit at a time.
Yeah, especially because we tried to tackle it in a way that covered most of the sporting bases that we could. So You'll see a lot of examples. There's some running, and then there's, of course, things like basketball and baseball and shot put and rugby and swimming and kayaking. So it's hard. It's a one thing that's just on running. So our book really covers a lot of generalities on how you do these things for sport preparation. And then we give examples of different sports. And then you maybe want to look through maybe another reference with maybe more running specific examples with a coach to kind of piecemeal these together. So our perspective is like, we wanted to put this out there for and athletes to understand how to do this for sport in general. And then you would work with your individual coach who maybe is a runner or a rugby player or whatever, and take these ideas and they would have great insights as to how to actually implement these things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And it really is just a ton of information. I was reading it and thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I need to highlight things in here and then come back to them and reconsider them because there's just so much information and it's good information. But for me, at least, I want to ponder it and kind of say, well, how does this apply to runners? How can I use this in a comprehensive way?
Yeah, it's tough for running because running goes against the grain of a lot of the periodization stuff that we do in traditional sports and like our strength and power type sports, which follow a pretty straight and narrow path. There's usually kind of one clear direction that we go. In running, we kind of go we literally go the opposite direction in many instances. So it can be kind of, and a lot of the stuff sometimes gets left in the dark where people say, okay, I get all the sports stuff, but I don't want to be a soccer player. I'm a runner. What do I do? And so we touched on it as best as we could. But I think, of course, as you know, there's so many nuances to individual difference in running programming that at that point, you do want to have a coach or somebody that you trust who can help you disseminate some of this stuff for yourself.
Right, right. Well, do you work with runners directly or is this something more that someone else would be, a better resource?
I do work with runners, but I actually have a couple colleagues at Renaissance Periodization, the place that I work, who are way more qualified than me. We have Dr. Alex Harris. He actually was on the bobsled team, but he works with a lot of track and field, decathletes, runners. We also have a couple other people who are really, really good. Mm-hmm. They actually just put out a big endurance nutrition book with Dr. Melissa Davis, who I call Dr. Wife. But they did a whole like really nitty gritty approach to nutrition on like fluid and electrolyte balance and how to map out your calories and carbohydrates and all those things. And they did a fantastic job. It's
awesome.
It's not just for running. They also cover, you know, like triathlon, Ironman, all that other stuff, but running's certainly a big part of it.
Cool. And what was the name of the book?
If you don't know it right now, maybe I can get it from you.
I'll get it from you and we'll put it in our notes.
Okay,
that would be great.
Yeah, for sure.
Tapering, peaking, and supercompensation, that kind of fits in with what you were just talking about. So can you help us understand better how these parts of periodization work for runners?
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about that fitness fatigue paradigm earlier. And so what it basically does is try to maximize the relationship of fitness and fatigue so that we can have our best performance at competition. So what a taper is a period where we're incrementally lowering our training volume so that that fatigue dial gets dialed down. And then our fitness dial starts to skyrocket. And what we actually find is that a really good taper will sometimes take our total training volume down to maintenance levels or maybe even below maintenance levels so that for a very short amount of time, people hit a true peak in their performance where all their fatigue is gone. And what that allows is all that dormant fitness that has been waiting to manifest for weeks and months on end finally comes out in a big explosion that might only last for like a day. Right. And that's where this timing idea becomes very important. And then we see this huge amount of fitness become expressed. And what we find is not only do people recover their previous abilities, but they actually see what we call, as you mentioned, supercompensation, where now they're actually performing super maximal abilities to what they have been doing up until that point. Pretty cool. And this is a really well-documented phenomenon. And what's really neat for your listeners is that running and endurance sport in general is really where the peaking and tapering literature came from. So we struggle more on the strength side of things to justify tapering, but for the endurance side of things, oh my goodness, all of the papers, all of the mathematical modeling come from endurance athletes. And there's a fantastic book that I can reference to right off the top of my head. It's called Tapering and Peaking for Optimal Performance by Inigo Mujica, Mujika. It's an entire book on how to properly set up peaking and tapering protocols for your races. And it's a fantastic read. It's a little dry. It's basically summarizes a huge body of literature, but most of the literature that it summarizes uses endurance athletes. So for your audience, it's probably a really great reference.
All right. Well, thank you. That sounds terrific. So this idea of supercompensation is something that for runners, you really have to make it fine-tuned. I mean, for like a day or something, you're saying that it's really that fine-tuned.
It depends on like how nitpicky you want to be about it. What I would say is it's probably, if we were to put it like on a graph, your performance would kind of hit like a curve and like a peak, right? So that peak could potentially be really sharp, which may mean that like the exact second of the day matters, right? Yeah. And that is a feasible thing to think about. Well, more likely what we would see is kind of a tangible increase in improvement like several days, and then it would start to go back down. Now, going back down means it's no longer supra maximal compared to what they have been doing in training. So what that means is like after the super compensation period wears off, they would essentially go back to what they would do on a Tuesday, which is probably still fine as well, right? But there's a narrow window of time that we can just benefit from, which is pretty neat.
It's very cool and fits in so well with the whole concept of periodization. I do remember one race that I was in where I was definitely fit, I was healthy, and I was so excited to run. You know, it was just so like everything came together at the same time. And so I think that's the kind of thing that you're talking about, having all those pieces come together so that mentally, spiritually, whatever, you know, you just really are into this thing as well as you put in all the rest of the time for the other aspects of it.
Well, it's a line, right? You had all of those things like finally came together. And usually that is confirmed when we see like improvements, not only in your performance, but if we looked at like some of your physiological measurements, like your heart rate or like your hormone levels, we look at your perceptive measures. Like, how do you actually feel? Did you report like less anxiety? All these things, all of those would help confirm like, yep, you did a good job with however you set it up last time. And then of course, like, you know, things like time of day and weather and, you know, mood. All that stuff gets affected too, but it always feels good when you have a good competition day like that, when all the stars align.
Yeah, indeed. Now, we haven't really touched on nutrition much at all, and I'd like you to do that. I know we're getting short on time here, but in terms of, again, having a comprehensive program, nutrition has to be part of that. And how does fat, carbohydrate, and protein fit into a nutrition program for an annual plan?
So the most important thing before we even get into some of that nitty gritty stuff is by far calorie balance. And that's is no surprise to any runner, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things you have to consider, right, at any given time is what is your calorie state, because that's going to be the most powerful influencer on anything that you do. So if you want to have a bad performance, first thing you can do is start eating less, right? And if you want to have a really good performance, you want to at least be kind of in a net neutral, meaning like an isocaloric phase where you're eating as much as you're expending. Mm-hmm. And then actually in many cases, sometimes being in a hypercaloric state can improve performance even more. But what's the downside of that? Well, the downside of that is you might be getting fat at the same time.
Yeah.
So there's this idea of calorie balance, which is really important. And it's very important in periodization because from the nutritional side of things, body composition management is very important. We want our athletes to be competing at their ideal body weight and body composition when those times arise, which means that throughout the year, we might be trying to gain muscle mass or lose body fat to put ourselves in condition. And so calorie balance is going to be the most influential thing on that. So within that idea of calories, those calories come from carbs, fats, and protein. And what we find is that protein tends to be really important for muscle mass gains and maintenance.
Totally.
But our runners typically aren't the most jacked people on the planet, right? Which is not a neg on them at all. It's actually inefficient for them to be carrying around a ton of muscle mass, right? So what we usually look at with runners, we say protein is important because it makes up the building blocks of the muscles, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't need a huge representation of your calories necessarily coming from protein. What do we really want? Well, it turns out carbs tend to be a really, really good choice in terms of calories, right? We want a very large portion of our calories coming from carbohydrates because the carbohydrates are going to be directly fueling a lot of the exercise that we do, as well as setting in the recovery adaptive processes after the exercise is over.
Interesting.
Fats are also really useful. I think sometimes there's a big debate on, you know, how fats are. I think that they're maybe less important than carbohydrates on the net, but fats still have a very good role in endurance training. And one of the nice things about fats is that it's a really big bang for your buck in terms of calories per gram.
Yeah.
So one of the easy ways to slam a lot of calories is by eating a lot of fat, whereas carbs, although tend to be more delicious and appealing, can be difficult for a lot of athletes. So for example, if you have a competitive triathlete maybe, who they might be eating upwards of 10 grams of carbs per pound of their own body weight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you realistically get like all these calories from carbohydrates? It's going to be hard. It's going to be a lot of fruit. It's going to be a lot of rice. It's going to be a lot of drinks and stuff. So sometimes it's actually better for the athlete in terms of managing their stress from eating as well as their GI distress that might be giving them, you know, bloating or diarrhea, something like that. Maybe bring a little bit more of those calories in from fat. Something like olive oil, you can dump in a couple teaspoons of olive oil into your rice. You don't even know it's there. And the next thing you know, you just added a huge amount of calories.
Right.
Actually, I watched Carl Metzer. I watched his documentary on the Appalachian Trail record and some of the things that he was doing. It's on Netflix. It's him trying to break the record for completing the Appalachian Trail from start to finish. And I mean, it's one of those things where, like, on paper, you would say, okay, we want to make sure that your carbs are X, Y, and Z, and your hydration and your sodium and potassium levels. This guy is just slamming pizza, right? He's just like, I need to eat as much calorie-dense food as I can just to stay on my feet and stay alive at this point.
Right.
So there's a funny balance we play with that. But all of them are important. And I think carbohydrate, though, is probably the big one that we want to manage and make sure is in a proper place. After that, there's plenty of room for individual difference and preference to get the right balance of carbs and fats. And protein, we're more looking at, let's just not lose muscle at the current time, rather than let's focus on eating so much protein that we're gaining lots of muscle.
Right. And this is different from one sport to another. So with runners, you're talking specifically runners, and the protein amount is different than if you were lifting.
Yeah. And that might change too. So if you have somebody who runs for fun, but also wants to be muscular, they might find that throughout the year, they might have periods where they're eating more protein to accommodate the wanting to gain more muscle. And then in their running season, they might bring that down closer to maintenance values.
I think the book does a good job of talking about some of those distinctions. And also it addresses fast food versus healthy food. And you can eat a lot of fat, but if it's all in French fries from a fast food restaurant, it's going to be less beneficial than if you're eating healthy carbohydrates, healthy fats, and getting some protein in there as well.
We want, you know, our sport outcomes and our health outcomes to overlap as much as possible. But the reality is, in sport nutrition, we're more concerned about how is this person going to be performing rather than like what necessarily later. So sometimes I'm reluctant to admit there are lots of times in sport nutrition where we have people do what are seemingly unhealthy things simply because things like calories just tend to be so much more powerful than what the actual food content is.
Interesting.
A hard pill for people to swallow. So yeah. I had a great example. I had a colleague who was coaching women's volleyball. They had a big tournament. A bunch of their games went the full distance. So these girls are playing, you know, five or six matches several times a day.
Whoa.
On the one hand, it's you would say, okay, girls, like, let's break out your big Costco bowl of fruit and some whole grains and stuff like that, right? Really healthy. But what's the limiting factor to them performing tomorrow at the tournament? How much carbohydrate can you get into their system? And so he very brilliantly had them go to, I think they went to like Olive Garden or something. He made them drink 2 glasses of their choice of regular soda, not diet, but like regular soda. They ordered first, and then they had at an avo. So the goal was to get as much sugar and things that are rapidly, easily digesting into the body as quickly as possible, rather than load up on other things like if they got like a chicken marsala, which is good, but it's going to fill them up because of all the protein and fat, and then they won't be able to get as much carbs in later. So on the one hand, you might say, like, you're having these girls drink Sprite and eat ice cream.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, well, the goal is for them to perform well tomorrow, not necessarily to pass, you know, a blood panel test, right? That's the idea.
Right.
We want the health and the performance to overlap as much as possible, but there is an important distinction in sport nutrition where we say it's not always the same.
And sometimes we do unhealthy. Yeah, and if something actually sounds good to you and you want to eat it, and maybe it is, you know, McDonald's French fries or something, then that may be the best choice for that particular moment.
Exactly. And if the science shows that, you know, calories are more important than whether it's a boiled sweet potato versus a French fry, like, who cares? Go for the French fries. It's better than enough.
Yeah. Oh, I like that a lot. I mean, I'm really glad you introduced that concept, because we're not going to be eating a diet of French fries for the whole year, but once in a while, it's the kind of thing that maybe it makes that mental as well as that actual physiological difference to be the best thing.
Absolutely. And the other thing too that's worth pointing out is that your lifestyle at that point as a competitive athlete is very much offsetting like whatever couple bad meals that you have every now and again. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not like you ate McDonald's once and now your health is in the toilet. It's like, well, you're so active all the time. Like, come on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Now that they're like pre-diabetic, get out of here.
Okay, well, we are actually coming to the end of this part of the interview. Is there anything that you want to add as kind of a summary of what we've been talking about before we move into the final kick?
So like just again, like when we think of training, when we think of periodization, everything that we do should have a purpose. Everything that goes into your training plan, be distinctly moving you towards the goals that you have. And that should come from all the different sources, the training, the nutrition, the psychological preparation, the recovery, all of those things. So try not to think about them as individual pieces. We want to try and move people to think about, how do I get all of these things on the same wavelength at the same time?
I like that. And I also think realistically that having a coach there that you have a good rapport with can make a huge difference, because then you've got the input from someone else. And part of what a good coach in my mind does is actually allow you to, you know, have this conversation. We're going back and forth about what you need. It's not like I'm just telling you what you need. And I'm only alluding to me in that way as representing a coach. Any coach who is a good coach is going to be listening to their runner as well, and allowing that kind of feedback, that kind of interaction that is so essential for top performance in anyone.
Absolutely, right. And that the best coaches out there are going to be the ones who can help take that science and take the individual and put in together to get the best outcomes, and not just say, like, this is what I know to be true, you must obey, right? It's both.
Do it.
Know the individual, know the science, and try and find the right compromises to get your athlete where you want.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the talents of being a good coach. Okay, so we are going to move into the final kick. You know about the final kick, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and you've probably had a few final kicks in your career. So this one is pretty straightforward and not too stressful. Let's start with a favorite local training run, something that our readers would hear enough about from you so that if they came to your area, they'd be able to actually do a run there.
Oh, man. So Orange County is really great. There's a ton of different park systems here. There's more running trails and hiking trails than you can count. But one of my favorite ones is Crystal Cove State Park. It butts up against the ocean. And there's this beautiful series of canyons and mountains that kind of make a big, for lack of a better term, horseshoe kind of shape around the ocean. And it's wonderful to do. You can trail run, you can hike, you can walk, you can just chill out. There's tons of animals. You'll see all sorts of wildlife there. So just be aware. It's a little bit exposed. So, you know, bring water and shade accordingly, but it's a great place to do some running and some hiking.
Wow. Thank you for that suggestion. Now, what about a recommended book, research, or video that you think would be of interest to our listeners?
I'm preaching to the choir here, but I really enjoyed the documentary on the Barkley Marathons on Netflix. That was really good.
Right.
There was an excellent one called, I think it was called Iron Cowboy, which follows this guy who does 50 triathlons in 50 days in 50 states. It's completely bananas. he manages to pull it off. It's really good. And then I think I already mentioned the Carl Metzer one on the Appalachian Trail hiking for completion time was really good.
Cool. Okay. And another person you would recommend that you know for us to interview on our podcast?
One of my colleagues at RP, Dr. Alex Harrison, would be a really, really great person to speak to. He's been involved in a variety of sports and a staple of his training programs forever. He's actually an Olympian. He was on the men's Olympic bobsled team.
Whoa.
Which is pretty cool. But he's one of those freaky guys you put him in any sport, he wins. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter. He's one of those guys. He's great, super smart, super accomplished. It would be great for you.
Okay, so now is your time to give us as much contact information as you have, how our listeners can stay in touch with you personally, purchase your book, find out more about, is it RP or REP? I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, we just call it RP for short because we mentioned the name. It tends to be a little long and tedious for people. So you can find me on the Renaissance Periodization website, or we just call it RP or RP Strength on Instagram. My colleague and I, Dr. Mike Isretel, we do a weekly webinar every week where people write us questions and we just answer them right in on the spot.
Cool.
Like hearing our banter there, you can see our videos on YouTube, stuff like that. And then I'm also on Instagram, but I mostly just post pictures of my fat cat. I'm RP Dr. James. And not much sports going on there. Mostly just fat kitties.
Okay. Well, for those of us who have cats, maybe that would be fun. And just to clarify the spelling of your name, it's James Hoffman, H-O-F-F and M-A-N-N. So H-O-F-F-M-A-N-N. And evidently that's an important thing for finding you because there's some other James Hoffmans out there.
Yeah, there's another sports scientist with a similar name who is way more famous than me. So it's a funny problem.
Okay. Well, James, thank you so much for talking with us today. Boy, did I get a lot out of this. Really appreciate this and this whole concept of integrated periodization. periodization.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a hoot to talk shop, and thanks again.
And thank you, our audience, for joining us for today's podcast at Run to the Top. You can follow us at the Runners Connect Winner's Circle on Facebook by going to runnersconnect.net/FB. Please subscribe to Run to the Top podcast at runnersconnect.net or on Apple Play, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, etc. You'll be notified that way every week when the new episode is published. And thank you, each of you, for listening. We'll be back next week with another super interview to entertain, educate, and inspire you as you head out on your running workout. Now, don't ask me to spell integrated periodization, please. Have a great day. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.